Welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv. Great to have everybody on board today. What I'd like to talk about today is something that's very, very topical. And it's something that, you know, as a nation and as a world, we are becoming borderless. And a lot of our products and things that we're using in construction and our buyers and our sellers in some instances are on an international scale. And I thought it'd be a good topic to actually have a little bit of a discussion about what's happening in Australia, how the market's being affected in Australia because of this international pressure, and also how, you know, even from a construction perspective, having the availability now with the internet being what it is and emails and easy correspondence and all this kind of stuff, which 20, 40, 60 years ago was unheard of, just makes our whole construction industry and our end product very different. It changes our market. It changes the way we think about things. It changes what we look for in architecture, all sorts of things. And I thought it'd be a great discussion topic to actually explore the international flavour of what's going on in Australia and how particularly our relationship with China has really changed the landscape in Australia. On two fronts I want to talk about. Now, the first front is obviously from a material basis and how a lot of our materials that go into our end products, you know, construction is one industry, but in every industry as well, and how a lot of us are now thinking, well, you know, why wait for an importer to bring it in? Why not bring stuff in ourselves? And what that actually means and what are the risks and what are the cost savings and all of those sorts of things. So I'd like to explore that in our little talk this morning. And I'd also like to explore our end products, as in newly constructed properties, even our old properties. And is it something that's sort of the next chapter that we should be looking at and marketing our properties when we want to sell them to an international market? Now, I actually have my very dear friend with me today, who I've known for quite a number of years, who actually lives in China. And he's been involved in the construction industry for a lot of years. He's also had experience both in Australia and internationally from a construction perspective, and now lives in China. His name is Joshua Hunt. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, Dimna. Hello, everybody.
Great to have you on board. Now, let's talk about you to give everybody a little bit of a background on you.
Okay.
You've done quite a degree of developing in Australia and internationally.
Yes.
And what do you do now? Well, first of all, step back a bit. What took you to China? Why did you decide to go and leave the beautiful Sunshine Coast and go to China?
Well, I've been involved in the building and development game in Australia for the last 20 years. And the thing that first drew me to China was the fact that a lot of the building materials that I was buying were all built in China or constructed in China. And I thought, well, why am I paying this middleman? Why don't I go directly? So about 13 years ago, maybe 14 years ago now, is when we first went to China to start looking at bringing our own building materials in for our own developments. And so we've done many hundreds of millions of dollars worth of developments, from resorts to hotels to residential real estate. And we started being involved in China purely from a sourcing of building materials directly from Chinese manufacturers.
So what made you move and take your kids over there and live over there?
Well, at the time, the GFC had hit pretty hard and the market was really very slow, I even say dead here in Australia from a real estate sales perspective. And there really wasn't a lot happening from the property market. So we thought, well, now's a great opportunity to expand our international side. And China really wasn't that affected by the GFC like Australia was.
Okay. So you moved and uprooted the family, took them all over to China. And primarily you were looking at materials and construction on an international basis. And you decided to specialise in, well, a number of things, but modular being one of them, and sourcing materials for other people being another.
Yeah, well, there was two main, let's say three main lines of our business. One was we're involved in a project over here in Australia that could have been modular. And at that time, I thought, well, let's move our construction team to China rather than just bring in the building materials. Let's bring in the completed finished buildings. Mm-hmm. And so that took us down a particular line where we built modular. And Dimna, you and some of your group, Platinum Group, have actually been to our modular manufacturing facility in Yantai, China. And we're now building modular buildings all over the world. The name of that company is Wanhua Modular Projects.
How do you spell that?
W-A-N-H-U-A, Wanhua Modular Projects.
And obviously you guys can look that up for yourself. Now, with the modular stuff, we'll start there. You have a manufacturing facility over there, and I mean, dealing with a lot of that type of thing myself, you've got to have the Australian standards, and that's something that I think as Australians we think, well, you know, is the quality really there, and does it meet Australian standards? Are we going to pay all this money, get something into Australia, and then it doesn't comply and it sits on the docks? What's your answer to that?
It's a very real issue. It's not something that, you know, a one-liner can gloss over. Meeting the Australian Building Standards from a developer's point of view is amazingly important. And so it's not something that we gloss over lightly. But, you know, in China, they're global manufacturers, not just manufacturers for the Chinese market, not just manufacturers for the Australian market. And so we've faced this problem from a modular manufacturing point of view, meeting building standards for regions all around the world. And so the way that we deal with that issue, my business partner is an Australian qualified builder. But the way that we deal with that issue from a global perspective is when we do a job in Australia, we'll engage a team of Australian engineers, certifiers and plumbers, electricians, waterproofers, everything that's needed for Australian compliance. And we'll do it on a project basis. So we'll bring in that team and drive that project through with our full Australian compliance and team that are required to make that job compliant.
Mm. And that's a big call, because if you're not actually dealing with an Australian over there, a lot of them don't really understand the absolute nitty-gritty of our standards. And our standards are actually the highest in the world. We're the biggest pain in the neck to deal with on an international basis because our standards are so high.
Yeah, that's very true. And that's why it's very difficult to have a team in China that just fully specialise in the Australian standards, because it's even state-specific. And so, you know, as far as China is concerned, Australia is a great market, but a small market. Mm. And that's why what we do is we'll have a team, and a lot of our guys are in New South Wales, but then for state-based certification, we will have engineers or certifiers based in each particular state that we work with to get the certification that we require.
And you build modular now for the whole world. I mean, you know, you've sent stuff to Africa and Kazakhstan and Malaysia, and where else have you done stuff?
Oh, the UK, Singapore, but all over the world. So it really is a truly international business.
Okay, so that's one side of your business. And you know, from your advice to somebody perhaps thinking of bringing in modular to Australia, what would you say to them?
Modular is not the answer for every question. Some people think that, oh, I'll do modular out of China because it will save me a fortune. It's very difficult. In Australia, we have the residential home builders that have done a very good job of building at a cost-efficient square meterage rate. And so it's very difficult for a modular manufacturer to actually compete in the $1,000, $1,200 a square meter construction space. But where modular is very good is when building hotels or we're doing aged care facilities and that type of thing, where the square meterage rate creeps up. Or in regional areas that also the square meterage rate is higher.
Is that because when you bring it in, it's all done, all finished, and with all the, you know, the finishings are there, the furnishings are there, all of the higher end stuff can be put in at the same cost as it would be for just general building somewhere else?
Yeah, as well as the fact that when you're bringing in a hotel, there's not a lot of open space. But when you're building a residential house, there might be two bathrooms, only one kitchen, in 200 square metres of space. And we ship space. It costs us a lot for a volumetric logistics cost to move space. So we want that space to be as expensive as possible. And in a hotel, you've got every 20 square meters, you've got a bathroom and a kitchenette. And, you know, it's a lot more expensive as far as square meterage space is concerned.
Okay. So that's one side of your business. Another side of your business is you actually source materials for builders and developers over here, like doors and windows and flooring and all of that sort of thing, if people want to have a you know, use you more as an agency for raw materials.
I've been taking builders and developers to China for quite a lot of years, and what we've discovered is everybody's trying to cut the middleman out, and so we were very deliberate in our choice not to become another middleman. Mm-hmm. And so what we did, we set up a company some years ago called Fusion Yantai, and the purpose of that company is not to be a middleman that puts an additional commission on, but it's really a labour hire business that you can hire one of our staff at an hourly rate to do everything from procurement to graphic design or whatever you choose to, but they are Chinese people, bilingual Chinese people, that can really be your employee in China, and if you're doing procurement, we have a lot of experience in that space.
One of the things that I often find in dealing in Asian countries generally is there's a lot of kickbacks, and you know, you come to my shop and buy off my cousin whatever, and I get a kickback. That's one of the things that you've been very conscious to try and squash.
Yeah, absolutely, and you're right. It is rife throughout the Asian culture, but our staff are on very strict contract agreements that basically says that there's no kickbacks, there's no commissions, they simply work for a wage, and if they get caught doing that, there'll be legal proceedings and very expensive costs.
So, you know, if someone's got their own contacts over there, fine. But if someone wants to go in cold, you know, Fusion's a great opportunity to have someone on the ground who can, A, speak the language, but also negotiate on your behalf, check quality control, organise shipping, all of that logistical stuff, which you need somebody on the ground to do.
The interesting thing, Dimpna, is a lot of people don't know how to negotiate with Chinese people.
Mm-hmm. And that's what does that mean?
That's where they get caught. And it's not that the Chinese are out to rip them off, but, you know, you can get on a plane and go to China and go to a factory and negotiate directly with the factory. But it really does help to have experience in how to negotiate with a factory. And what I mean by that is in Australia, we are not used to different standards. And let me be specific. We have a minimum expectation of standards because we have
quality,
which is very good in regards to our government has said, you know, our tapware's got to have a watermark, et cetera, et cetera. And it means that it's of a certain quality. Mm-hmm. But in China, they build for the entire world market. So they build for the cheapest market and they also build for the most expensive market. But one of the problems that I find when I take builders or developers to China is that they are thinking so much about price that they've forgotten to emphasize to the Chinese client the most important thing, which is the quality of the product that they're looking for. And so our staff are a lot more aware of what those quality expectations are because they deal with Australian clients all the time. And then they make sure that even if a Chinese factory says, well, I'll do it a bit cheaper, they ensure that the quality is not going to be reduced to an extent where all of a sudden that is now not usable in the Australian market, which is what happens a lot when people deal directly with Chinese factories and don't know how to negotiate.
Just explain that a little bit more. I mean, you told me a story about, you know, negotiating on a chair. Do you want to recant that story for me?
I had some builders and I took them to a furniture place and they were looking at a chair and they said, how much is the chair? And the person said, that chair is $40. And the Australian builder went straight into what normally happens from a builder and they negotiate on price and they said, I'll give you $20 for the chair. The Chinese factory owner then turned around and said, okay. What we then stepped in and sorted this issue out, because let me tell you what's going to happen, is the Australian said, I'll give you $20 for that $40 chair. The Chinese factory owner heard, I don't have $40. Can you build me a $20 version of that chair? And what would happen is they would all agree, the Australians thinking that he got a $40 chair for $20. The factory thought that they didn't have $40. They wanted the $20 version of that chair. And when the chairs arrive in Australia, the Australian then thinks I've been shafted by the Chinese because he built me rubbish. This is not what I saw. But it's really not what you negotiated for.
Hmm. Big, big difference there. And that's a cultural thing that I think, you know, we forget where in Australia. I mean, places like Europe and that sort of thing, you know, you're dealing with different cultures, different borders, different things all the time. Whereas we're very isolated over here in Australia, and we get very parochial about the way things should be or the way we're used to doing them. We think that's how everybody else should be and everybody else should adapt to our way. When actual fact, you've got to understand the culture of the, you know, the area in which you're negotiating, whether it be buyer, seller, supplier, you know, whatever, to really make sure that you're actually speaking the same language. Mm. Even though the words are the same, the meaning may not be.
Yeah. And we know of China as being the world's manufacturer. Mm. What you need to understand is when you're dealing with the world's manufacturer, he's used to building at every different world standard,
yep,
not just the Australian standard.
Yep.
And so you need to know your standards very, very well so that you agree on a particular standard or quality to ensure that that's what you get.
Hmm. Okay, now the other side of your business, which is why it's great to talk to you this morning, is you're actually now bringing Chinese buyers to the Australian market.
Mm.
And looking for properties that the Chinese want to sell, want to buy, I mean.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about that as to, because obviously, you know, our borders are becoming very international, and it's something that we've got to understand what the buyer wants. And if we're selling to a Chinese buyer, then what do they want? Do you want to just run through what that actually means?
Sure. Yeah, so we have a division of our Fusion Yantai business called...
Just spell it, so everyone can...
Fusion is F-U-S-I-O-N, Yantai, Y-A-N-T-A-I.
F-U-F. Sorry, F-U-S.
Yeah, F-U-S-I-O-N, Fusion. Sorry. Did I spell that wrong?
Yeah, I think you put an F in the wrong place. Okay. I thought you said S-U-F, I'm going, huh?
No, F-U-S-I-O-N, FusionYantai.com, and then we have a real estate division of that. And our real estate division really works with Chinese-based investors. These are not Chinese that are in Australia or Chinese that are anywhere else other than in China and looking to invest internationally. And so for many years we've been working with Chinese investors in where they would like to actually hold international investment property, and a major, major, direction for the Chinese investor is the Australian market. And they have that desire to invest in the Australian market for a number of different key reasons.
Okay, go on. So what location, what are they after?
Okay, so A Chinese investor is looking for a number of things when investing into the Australian market. And the first one is really location, location, location. Now, the thing is, you and I understand from an Australian perspective of what location, location, location is, but a Chinese investor has a different version of what makes a great location to what we think makes a great location.
Yeah, we like the beach and... You know, the wide open spaces, whereas the Chinese investor likes density and security.
The thing that is one of the most important things for the Chinese investor is basically how close it is to public transport and good schools or universities.
Hmm.
So before you say, you know, we're opposite the beach and you can look out the window and see the fantastic view, when selling a property to the Chinese, the first thing you should highlight is how close you are to public transport. And the main reason is just about everybody in China use public transport is because there's just so many people in China they can't all have a car. There just wouldn't be enough space on the roads. So when a Chinese person is saying, what's going to make this property great, accessibility to public transport is a very high priority to them. Even though it may or may not be a high priority to an Australian person, you're selling the property to someone with a different mindset. And yep. So you've got to highlight what they think is important to your property. And location is one, with public transport, schools and shops, universities and hospitals, and then public spaces. And the reason is, public spaces are very important to the Chinese because normally their houses are small, and the public spaces is where the family then breaks into, so you might go and spend the afternoon with your wife and sit down in the park. And so where we have, you know, big houses and we invite friends over, that doesn't happen in China. So accessibility to public spaces is really there because they are used to smaller homes.
Okay. Now, what about, so we're talking major capital cities here. Really, you can forget any developments outside the capital cities of each state.
Yeah. Our main focus is Melbourne, Sydney, and Gold Coast, and fourthly, Brisbane, not so much. But certainly those four are our main key. And the main reason for that is they're the four places in Australia that the Chinese person's actually heard of.
Yeah.
You know, I was in a seminar in Sydney a few weeks ago, and the a Chinese girl in the seminar said, I went to the Gold Coast a couple of weeks ago. I didn't like it because there was hardly anybody there. It felt spooky. You got to understand that the Chinese are just used to density.
Yeah.
They are comfortable in that space. And so you might say, oh, this regional property, it's beautiful, wide open spaces. But it feels too much out of their comfort zone to be comfortable in that space, yeah.
Mm. So development land, or what are they after there?
Well, there are certainly some property developers in China that are looking to move into the Australian market. That's not really where we specialise. We specialise in residential property in those four major locations, because it's a lot more transactional. As soon as you move into development land, there's a lot more complexity when it comes to, the time that you need to spend with a Chinese investor to get them comfortable with how that development could possibly work.
And they tend to like new.
They do tend to like new. You know, a friend of mine has done a residential development in Yantai, and it's a three-story townhouse with your own block of land. Now, your block of land is about 10 square metres. Tiny it is. But they're all sold out, but they aren't living in the house. And so what you do is you drive through this amazingly expensive, beautiful gated community, and you'll see people farming their 10 square metres of land, but their house is empty.
Why do they leave the house empty?
Well, they leave the house. It's like a new car to us. They think that if somebody's lived in the house, it's now not worth as much money. Like, you've just driven the car out of the car yard. Now it's a second-hand car. It's not worth as much money. And so that's the way that they see houses. And so they'll farm their little 10-square-metre block of land, but no one will live in the house.
So tell me, why are Chinese looking at Australia? Why do we have this influx of interest?
Well, there's a couple of key reasons of why Chinese like to actually buy in Australia. I'll go through the key ones so that you can understand. Number one is China is becoming a lot more aware of the international world. And so they want their children to have international opportunities and an international education. And they see Australia as being able to deliver a high quality of international education. So that's one. The second one is that they see Australia as being a very stable economy and a stable government. You know, we perform very well through the GFC. You know, we don't have coups in our government, even though, you know, we may consider some of them being a coup, but they see our government as being very stable.
We keep toppling the leader.
Yeah, well, they don't see that as important as this toppling of the government, I guess. So they see us as a stable place. The third point, which I think is the most driven in their head of the reasons that they like to invest, and that is they're looking for a plan B if their government changes the way that they're currently doing business in China. Let me explain that a little bit. A few months ago, the government were concerned in China about the overheating of the Chinese property market. And so they brought in a law. And this law was brought in overnight. Nobody had heard about it. Next day, it's law. And what the law was is that your second investment property would be taxed at 20% of its value on an annual basis.
Jeez.
And so that instantaneously slows down the property market because now the developers don't have the second investment property market out there because all of those investors don't want to pay that aggressive sort of tax.
Is that something where, you know, the wife can have one and the husband can have one and the first child can have one? And
it's very interesting. The divorce rate went up astronomically.
Because you had to be divorced.
Because they had to be divorced. And they're actually saying that it's a way that they could solve the tax. And there's been documentaries done on the spike of divorce in China purely because of getting around some of these taxes.
Isn't that funny? I've always heard of divorce as being an asset protection strategy, but not one of investment.
So, you know, the thing is that the Chinese are doing astronomically well at the moment. The amount of wealth in the country is unbelievable. And they are doing very well. But they are also concerned. They come out of a communistic mindset that what happens if the government turns around and says, we now all need to pool our funds again and you don't have this individual ability to become wealthy. That is very scary. And you and I do the same thing with asset protection and diversifying our risks and making sure that we're in different market segments. The Chinese are doing exactly the same. If they can have their child get an international education in Australia with the possibility of citizenship into the future or permanent residency, and then they can invest some of their money into that region, they think if the China government changes their mind and now all of a sudden we're not allowed to be wealthy in China, they have an exit strategy or a risk management strategy. And this is a very real pressure in the Chinese mind of the reasons they want to invest internationally.
The ownership in China is very different as well. When they own a piece of land or a building or whatever, they don't actually really own it. It's more like a leasehold, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we have a lot of developers come to us for financing. And they might come to us with their chest puffed out and say, well, we have no debt on our land. And the Chinese look at them and say, so? Like, who would have debt on their land? That's just ludicrous. and the reason is because in China, land really isn't worth that much. And it's because in 70 years, they give it back. It's really just leasehold land. And it's so that the government has control over the development of suburbs and that type of thing. And so when you say to a Chinese person that they can own this land forever, it is mind-boggling to them. A friend of mine, very wealthy in China, I go down to his basement in their own private entertainment facility. and I see down there these massive vats of baijiu.
Of what?
It's Chinese rice wines, very expensive. Okay. And I said to him, how much worth of baijiu is in this cellar? And he said $6 million worth of baijiu in this. And I hate this stuff. It is shocking. But I said, why the hell would you spend so much money? Are you going to drink this? And he says, no. It's for our children's children. He said, my grandchildren, this will be worth $100 million. And I was thinking about it, thinking, if the Chinese don't have property to leave to their children, what do they have?
Yeah, okay.
And so this guy, their family, has invested $6 million in baijiu as an asset for their children's children, where we do that with property. Mm. Our property increases in value and it's something that we can leave to our children, and that's great, but they don't have that. And so the perpetual ownership of land in Australia is something that is very, very exciting to the Chinese people.
So if you've got someone here in Australia who's looking to do a development and on-sell it or has something that they want to on-sell, you know, what advice would you give them if you wanted to market to the Chinese?
We do a lot of marketing a property to the Chinese, and it's not a quick process. Our process normally takes about 3 months on average. And the reason is we build a very comprehensive story. That story then needs to be translated into Chinese because most of the Chinese investors don't actually speak English. And then we actually put that out through all of our different sales networks. We have networks of real estate agents and developers and our own network of private investors. And this just takes time. And so the first thing that I'd say is don't expect if you're going to sell into China for it to be an instantaneously quick process. But I was talking to a developer a couple of weeks ago about it's very smart as an Australian developer or a builder to actually build these different markets into your business. The reason is, a few years ago, when the GFC hit, as a builder or a developer that only had the Australian market to generate sales, it didn't exist. And so it's a very smart risk management strategy to actually commit a portion of your business to say, I'm going to start to build a market in China, build a profile in China, so that irrespective of what happens in the Australian market, I've still got a division of my business that will continue to make sales, whether the property market in Australia here is hot or it isn't. And it's just a really good way to diversify your risks from a continuity of product point of view.
Yeah, it's interesting when you start thinking nationally, internationally, sorry, how your perspective on everything changes. And not only, like as we started with the input of product, but also the, you know, the desirability of what you're actually producing, and then the ultimate sale. You know, is your buyer going to be an Australian, or are they going to be from, you know, international fields? And we've talked today obviously about China, but that applies to a lot of different markets all around the world with different personalities and different things that they're actually looking for. And I think, you know, when you start thinking on an international basis, you step your business level up to the next stage. Well, Josh, it's been great talking to you today. Have you got any parting words of wisdom for those who are listening to us?
From the perspective of being an Australian developer and being involved in the building industry, what I looked at many, many years ago was the fact of, why am I paying a middleman a margin on bringing my building materials in from China if I can do that directly myself and give myself the competitive advantage in a competitive environment? Because how am I going to differentiate myself as a building or a developer if I'm buying all of the products at the same price? It really just comes down to how clever my architect is or my graphic design, but it's a way that you can be competitive. And I used to try and build a 5-star product at a 3-star price. That was my desire by being able
to import. That was your mantra.
Yeah, from importing from China. The second thing that I would say is actually start building an international clientele or database of potential investors into your product. It's a very good risk management strategy that when our, like at the moment, our Australian market is very good, but it doesn't always stay like that. And so as far as risk management is concerned, it's a smart thing to do to actually build your clients coming in from a number of different regions around the world.
Okay. And when we start to look at things like that, obviously your business is one of the businesses that are out there, but if people want to contact you, they can go through the websites?
Yeah, the best thing to do is have a look at our Fusion website. It's fusionyantai.com. Have a look at our website, whether you're looking for some assistance to run your business in China, whether you want to buy building materials from China, or whether you want to sell your real estate to Chinese investors. Have a look at our website and, you know, make contact with us from there.
Great. Well, thanks for coming along this morning, Josh, and giving up your one of your Easter mornings to talk to me, but I had to get you while you're in Australia. And I hope that's been helpful, everybody listening. And remember to jump on iTunes and subscribe to iloverealestate.tv and have the iTunes podcast come to you automatically and refer them to your mates. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll be back again to talk to you very, very soon. Bye for now.
Bye. Thank you.